So what string do you hear in each other that you might want to pick up on and speak to open up the conversation together? And could I ask you, when you do that, to just pass the microphone along to each other?
I guess what I appreciated very strongly and what I heard is that the is a message that I find also in the teaching of Jesus and in the practice of Jesus, that there's no place in the church for exclusivism. That there's when Jesus ministers to his own people, in the first place he goes to the marginalized, to people like the lepers and so on. And even when he uses statements like, you know, go first to the lost children of Israel, and with the Syrophoenician woman, where he talks, you know, basically calls the woman a dog, it's like Jesus himself is almost shocked by his own statements, and the gospel moves beyond those kinds of statements to the fact that the gospel is not just for Jews, but it's for Gentiles. Paul picks up on that very strongly, and so the whole breaking through of a community of the church as a righteous, self-righteous organization, as a self-affirming organization. The breaking through that, I hear that in both of my colleagues here, and I appreciate that very much. That because I think there is always that danger in the church that we become so preoccupied with our own growth, with our own preservation, with our own sense of we're the ones that belong, that is so easy to forget that we're primarily there as witnesses, as people who testify to the fact that God is breaking through in this world, including through our own lives.
I think it's also remarkable some of the similarities that came, and as Tom was talking about, was stressing how in Calvin we see this kingdom vision, or neo-Calvinism we see this kingdom vision of rediscovery, of seeing our God-centeredness lead us into what we do for within the public life, and the four things that you said, Dietmar, that were important in thinking about Luther's what marks Luther out as his vision of God. I think it all points us to the fact that it's that being drawn to God centeredness in these different ways that lead us to be able to impact public life in a particular direction towards transformation, and I see that as a strand, as a strand in all that we're saying.
Are there limits? I mean, the question that emerges for me is, how do you understand, and how does the tradition understand and negotiate the limits within a modern, complex public sphere, the limits to the particular values and perspectives that come from the church tradition, and that may even be required by church discipline? How does your understanding get at, and maybe I'm not framing it properly, there may be another way of framing it, but does it have a place in order to speak about the limitations of the Christian's endeavoring to exercise influence and or power within a pluralistic public setting? And if so, what? How are those limits understood?
Well, I struggled with that in my statement, and if you note, I introduced that part without any pretense to being superior. And I think that's those are some of the signs to thinking of what we are called to do in terms of there are limits as human beings we need to attend to. But if it is the sovereignty of God who sets the pace, and we are aware of that, then the limitation is how we respond to that sovereignty, rather than. And it's been inherent in the message we have. And sometimes responding to it, the temptation is to feel that we can impose from our side. So there are definitely limits, but there, it's in terms of how we respond to. God's sovereignty is without limits, but how we respond to it, we need to be conscious of the limits there are.
And is this notion then of sovereignty, does that say to you, because God is sovereign, and because I do not know in any complete and full way, in all situations, I must recognize that I am not sovereign, that my knowledge is not sovereign, and that I may not understand the full picture here. So is that yes, part of how it functions for you?
Precisely. And also for Christians, the challenge is to be able to also say, I can also hear part of what God wants to say to all of us in my neighbor, which is not always easy for the Christian to say, in my neighbor who is not a Christian. But yes, that kind of humility to be able to say, I don't know the full picture.
So only sphere sovereignty then means yes. Sphere modesty.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, nobody knows. But I don't have a whole corner on it for everybody, but maybe you have a...
Yeah, as I read Luther, and there's many Lutherans who don't necessarily, you know, you always, depends on which text you start as your key Luther texts. And since Zwingli is one of my direct ancestors, and I'm a Lutheran, it's good to have dealt with the sacramental text where Zwingli and Luther are arguing back and forth. But what that means for me, this notion of God clothed in creation, is in fact that all human knowledge is very limited. And therefore, in all the public sphere, economic, political, etc., it is not acceptable for the church to simply say, well, let's go to the Bible. The Bible has tons of different examples of, let's say, government forms. I mean, there's also slavery in the Bible. There's all sorts of things in the Bible. You can eat locusts, but you can't eat turkey vultures, you know, in case you were tempted. Anyhow, so you always have, your hermeneutics, how do you interpret the Bible? But for Luther, it's very important. No, we use, you know, in a certain sense when he says, well, love your neighbor. That's written in your heart and into reality. God has written that in. You don't even need the Bible for that. But to implement that, you need a good liberal arts education. With other words, we have to be able to critically think and dialogue with economists, for example, like Herman Daly tries that. He worked for eight years in the World Bank, and you know, Limits of Growth is one of his better ones. And he and John Cobb, right? Daly and Cobb published, you know, whatever the Toward a Common Future or whatever the title was, as an alternative way of evaluating. So you have theologians and economists working together, and you get different economic voices. So you fully understand. I think our challenge is we become very quickly ideological, or how we present. We go into committee and come up with social statements, but our parish hasn't got the ingredients of the thinking that has led to the final outcome. And so it appears to parishioners often simply as presumptuous. You know, you're just imposing this as some, you know, and in the U.S. in the Lutheran circles, it was very interesting. Two-thirds of the clergy were against the Vietnam War. Two-thirds of the lay people were in favor. You know, you can see there's a bit of a disjunction. So you know, to declare that as sin, what is the process you need for people to get into the conversation, and that we can respect difference at the same time there are points of status confessionis, right? You know, you can do no other, but you can only march out on each other so many times before we have, well, we already have 660 Protestant churches or something, so, you know, maybe a few more walkouts and we can create a few more. So how do you keep ultimately that we have a common faith in God with the very concrete differences that we will have? So that modesty, I think, if we acknowledge we're only dealing with not the naked God, not the God directly, we deal with God in creation as read by limited human minds. And so even in the Barman Declaration, right, it gave a limited sphere, you know, the state to the best of our human abilities and possibilities. But of course we can cop out on that, and that's why Setri's comments beforehand, but we also have to name exploitation of others economically is simply a sin, you know, and the gender inequality. So, you know, we can give a whole highlight service. Yeah, there's no question. But what that means concretely, we have to have enough humility. Otherwise, dialogue isn't of use. If we already know the end product, why dialogue? So hopefully we all emerge from a dialogue with a deeper understanding, maybe just deepening our own appreciation. So I think for me, this notion of God clothed in creation and then clothed in the history of Israel and in Jesus means that every time you proclaim a word, this is the God, a commandment of God, is really risk. Right? To just pass on platitudes, which the in-group would accept, the out-group won't, doesn't do much. So, you know, how do we learn risky proclaiming as well? But a lot of things we prefer to proclaim because it's safer. I feel safer behind the pulpit than in open conversation because my friends have very good arguments and they can ask all of those. I think so there are certain things you have to do in discussion groups. You know, just in fairness to the whole parish and for the unity of peace, do it in conversation rather than in... But obviously there is, you know, we do have to preach that, you know, God calls us to, you know, fairly clearly, but the implications often we do need that kind of conversation. So I think that's where our limitness comes in. And the other thing is very clearly from Bonhoeffer and I think from Luther is that we cannot be hegemonic. You know, the state is not a tool to impose our particular, let's say, okay, if the Pietists had their day and they imposed their will on the state, then there would be no smoking, that would be banned, there would be no drinking, there would be no swearing, there would be no dancing, whatever, and we'd just criminalize it or something, right? So, you know, of course we feel our version should be imposed by the state, but not those of the people we disagree with. So that already shows some of the, you know, the problems with that.
There would also be no socialism in Norway and Sweden.
Yeah.
Because that was a gift of pietism.
So, yes. Exactly.
But of an earlier generation.
Yes.
May I ask you, you know, jump in on this, please. I may repeat it so that we get it on the disc, if you don't mind.
I'm thinking often in the biblical.
So is there a particular place where you start in the biblical text that leads to the flowering of your theology around this issue? Lovely. Tom?
Well, I already mentioned one starting point, and that was the sovereignty of God. That plays a very strong role in the Calvinist tradition. But I think it depends which part of Calvinism you go to again. But certainly in the tradition I come from, the strong emphasis on creation, and on creation as being... God's work, God's and a sign of God's faithfulness, God's self-giving, and that Christ is understood in the context of God's work. Christ helps to relate to creation, and redeems creation. So that's where we work with this scheme of creation, fall, redemption. So the sovereignty of God in creating and in redeeming. That's what I, to put a short.
Can you just say a little bit more though, because I'm not entirely comfortable. I want to be comfortable. I mean,
that's
when
your objective. Okay, that's good.
My objective clearly is comfort. Yes. Sovereign. Look at the kind of sovereignty we see in the Scripture, and in the Christian tradition, and in the history of those cultures and civilizations which have had sovereigns. There is a big difference, it seems to me, between Charlemagne and the Frankish kings, and Jesus Christ enthroned on the cross. Can you say just a little bit more, Tom, about how, or the layers, the echoes within your tradition around the sovereign? It goes back really to this question I asked earlier about limitation and weakness. Is the sovereign, what's the character of the sovereign?
Okay, the character of the sovereign in that sense would be that God is the God is love. And I think we have to stress that, because I'm certainly very strong in my tradition for a long period of time, and this is confession of sin time, is that probably the sovereignty would have been expressed through the statement, God is truth. Mm. And I think we've moved away from that, fortunately, because if God is truth, then I have a weapon to hit people over the heads with.
And that truth is actually propositional.
Propositional, really, yes. When we say God is love, then we realize that God can only be known in relationship, in the act. When Dietmar was talking, I just made a little note, Ivan Illich. I just been reading his latest book that's the ideas lectures that were just rebroadcast recently, and I can never remember the title.
Israel of Christianity?
No, it's the river. Ivan Illich keeps on talking about discovering Christ always only in meeting your neighbor. That's why he's so strongly against institutions. Because you can, as soon as you institutionalize, for instance, mercy, then it immediately takes away the act of communicating with my neighbor. It may be doing lots of good, but as soon as I institutionalize it, like set up orphanages, for instance, and say, okay, so or have the government take over my responsibility, then it's always setting. It puts a distance between me and my neighbor rather than engaging my neighbor. And so when my neighbor is put in my path, I have to meet that neighbor, and in meeting that neighbor, I meet God. And that's where I discover something of the sovereignty of God, because God addresses me in that neighbor. It's not just a matter of I meet the neighbor, but I hear God speaking to me in that neighbor.
Yeah, in terms of starting points, I don't think one can give a particular text, although, of course, Bonhoeffer has his text. Luther has his text in Romans. But I think one can reduce Luther to his, existential experience of, a gracious God. Because he is a biblical teacher, in all his lectures, he's covered quite a bit of territory. So he would say, yes, Jesus is the center of Scripture. Within Jesus, the word of grace or forgiveness is the center. But what Lutheranism has done, and then there's various branches within Lutherans, of course, is right away cast that in the context of sin and grace. Luther actually, as my four little points indicated, actually has a very solid theology, and more what, like Tom was saying, of creation. And God's role in creation, our embeddedness in creation, and that actually faith and obedience are necessary. The word even is necessary, even if the fall hadn't occurred, so that we live by trust and obedience. So Luther, he, as all of us do when we lecture, he burbles a lot and whatever, but then he comes with moments of brilliance in between. So I think when he does Genesis 1-3, he gets some of his bursts of brilliance and just maybe imaginative leaps, but he would say, well, the copse of trees that they weren't supposed to touch, was he would take his family and they would worship there, because here God is indicating you are a limited human being. And that in itself is a gift. You do not have to manage the world. You don't have to take charge of the world. So that whole notion of a very solid theology of creation, and then sin, and God is already clothed, already hidden in creation, sin further blinds us, because then we see ourselves projected everywhere. And so then, sin and grace, that's sort of but it has to be creation, sin and grace, as the structure. If you don't start there, then the social dimension of Luther's thought gets lost. And Lutheranism tends to lose it very easily. Because then they just work, oh, well, he has two regiments, and he has law and gospel, and we like the one, and we don't like the other so much, you know, and then we lose it. But
I'm also struggling to find a particular starting point, and I've tried to read it either historically or even in its current expressions in the Reformed family, and I think it will either be Jesus as the center or sola scriptura as a whole rather than a particular starting point. However, again, going back to our responses to it in different historic times and different regions, even if you look at it currently, what is happening, for example, in the Pacific will determine a particular starting point for people in the same family. Sometimes even, I dare say for Lutherans and Reformed people in the same setting, creation may be the starting point there. For some of us, again, our history and our reality has made the sovereignty of God a good starting point for a long time. But I think to be faithful to our ancestors, I think it's very difficult to start from a particular or to pinpoint a particular starting point.
What about you? How do you, in your thinking and teaching, how does this surface for you?
I struggle with words like sovereign because I think if
the sovereign is enthroned on the tree,
yes.
And wears a crown of thorns between thieves.
Yeah, I mean, working on a whole theology of relinquishment, you know, or letting go. In Bonhoeffer's lecture, I mean, he actually hints at that, right? I mean, more literally, and you can see it in Gotzi preface to Bonhoeffer, the English translation of this Thy Kingdom Come lecture is there. And for the Christian this worldly, that people who impose with power their ideology, even though it's well-meaning and Christian and whatever, as they think, he challenges exactly and say, be weak. Right? And then, but of course you can say, well, trust in the power of the word, which is a very different thing. Right? If you're trusting the, a word, which can always be silenced, can always be jailed, you know, et cetera, and it's not terribly popular, you know, so you trust that weakness as a way that God becomes a presence in that context. But for my students, I find it quite liberating and, you know, following Walter Brueggemann a bit, but just to alert students that the prophets criticize always religion, economics, and politics. That in itself is liberating because they just think sovereignty, our version of this power, you know, and either they affirm or deny that this power exists, you know, over people, and when they realize, well, the prophets are fighting against these abuse of power versions of God, as they are fighting with the politics that is abusing religion for their own ends and as they're challenging economics, that becomes very liberating for a lot of them to see, you know, the Bible is full of that kind of critique of sovereignty, you know. But in a certain context, but you need a lot of work. I mean, that's why it's a cop-out to use Bonhoeffer in 1932 because there the language of Reich was dominant, and then to use the word Reich or kingdom, and we still pray it, so I guess we can, but we have to do work about it. How is that a counter-narrative, right? How is it a post-colonial or a counter-colonial narrative? And that work has to be done, and we don't often do it, and that's why exactly the language we have to really, I think both Lutheran and Reformed, we have to, like Lutherans have to emphasize more, I think, the clothed presence of God if they want to see that, and the limitedness of what we know, like we sound as if we know everything, right? And that's a version of power as well, you know, the know-it-alls, as if that's God's omnipotence all of a sudden or something, you know. And so I think we have to learn, a different language, a different discourse in our time today. But we can use, you know, our neighbor. I mean, where empire is used in a certain way, good and evil is used in a certain way, good empires and evil empires. You can play off that. Okay, well, that's not You know, what Christianity, look at, this is seen as the voice of the tempter. This is seen, you know, this has been criticized by every prophet, it's been criticized by Jesus, you know, in the world they lorded over you, it shall not be so among you. So all of those, you know, the language is there, and that is often very liberating, but we have to use that. I think we have to use that. I think, like your, I use that a lot, the Philippians 2, 5 to 11.
I just wanted to add, one of the reasons why I chanced upon, or I came to hook on the sovereignty of God as a helpful way forward after struggling with it for a long time is Moltmann and how Moltmann pictures the sovereign God, who empties, in the crucified God, for example, vis-a-vis some of his later works in which we see the sin of human power in wanting to become that sovereign. I mean, and that the play of the two, I think, is one of the things that we need to struggle with in order to come to what is it that is in that kingdom coming? I mean, to use the word kingdom again, that makes a difference in the world today.
If I can just play on this just one little bit. Is there an implication in the view you've expressed that the church within the public sphere around issues of policy and what have you would exercise its prophetic great vigor, but that it would not move to ask that something be criminalized that it was against? In other words, is it possible to make the critique, and is this part of what you're really getting at, make the critique with vigor because there is a terrible tragedy, terrible injustice, what have you, that is taking place. There's death dealing that's taken place. And speak in as deep, compassionate, and clear a way as possible. But not take that move to want to use the state's instruments of criminalization as a way of enforcing that, but actually to speak against that as well.
I don't have a lot of profundity in this except to say that only if we're willing to suffer, only if there's with a great deal of pain. I say that because I believe strongly in a what I would call a restorative justice. I pick up the term from can't think of his name right now.
Yoder.
No, yeah, Yoder too, but the Yugoslavian fellow. Just recently, we went through a situation in our congregation where our pastor was dismissed because of abuse. And that was a very painful situation for the congregation because a large number of people wanted to forgive, because that's the business of the church, to forgive. And people wanted to find a healing process. And I was among those. And at a certain point, because I was also in the council, this person had to be dismissed from his office. There was no way he could continue in his office because the allegations against him were far too serious. And we were caught within that struggle of finding some way of saying this person had to be called to account. And at the same time, we wanted to be there to draw this person into a community that could provide healing. And I think in the long run, I don't know if we failed in the explicit goals we had. I don't know if we failed completely. But all I know is it was an extremely painful process to acknowledge a friend who had hurt others in such a serious way. And then in a sense also turned his back on not wanting to be healed by us. And And I say very easily, if this person would come back into my sphere of my community again, I would say I would want to still work as a healing, forgiving influence. And it's kind of easy to deal with him right now because he's moved 1,000 miles away. But only in that sense. It's a struggle more than anything else.
I think there's a difference between the church as institution and how it speaks. And I think what you're saying, you know, that's its role then to speak vigorously, prophetically, whatever, on a given issue. But in active discipleship, we are also citizens, we're politicians, we are, in fact, a part of the state. And so I have to bring my insight, hopefully supported by various church communities and individuals who are writing to our government, but I have to bring that to the table and hopefully make good law and good policy. Luther, sometimes didn't turn out too well, but he wrote 1,000 letters to public officials, actually more than that, including comments on policy. You know, obviously it's a more hierarchical situation, right? Where you talk to the prince and hopefully the prince will do something. But in our context, you know, I think both the letter writing is very important. I think the church can speak vigorously on various issues. But in our act of discipleship, because all areas of life, therefore the political, economic, et cetera, is equally a part of our discipleship, we would work towards good laws.
These do not have clear-cut answers. And yes, the church has to struggle to be able to say, thus says the Lord, in a way that is not simply a tool of the state, on one hand being a tool of the state, on the other hand using the state as a tool to either criminalize what its agenda is or not. But there's also in saying, thus says the Lord, a calling often to dialogue with the state, to point out ways in which the state can acknowledge evil for the evil it is. And that also needs to happen. And in my office, for example, oftentimes when the church gathered, whether in a council or in a consultation, says about a particular evil that is happening, that such and such should be made clear to the government of such and such a state. And that making clear to the government may yield either a criminalizing of a particular kind of treatment or relationship. If that's part of what is yielded, it's okay. Sometimes in making that clear to the government, we also risk being marginalized, being imprisoned, being all kinds of things. But I think it will be difficult to make a clear cut. There are no times when when one can actually speak to the state in a way that they can take up a particular course. Everything, for example, we are saying on either the global economy as it is today. If we are speaking only among ourselves as churches, I think we may not be making any impact. There are times when we have to call a spade to those who are making the decisions and with the hopes that they can hear the voices of those who are suffering through these voices.
Oh, Henry.
Yes. On one hand, we're having institutions that are speaking on behalf of a tradition that has difficulty with to speak out on these issues.
Let me take the example of apartheid. When the churches started speaking about it in the late 60s and the 70s and so on, it was very clear that it was the evil of racism, the evil of setting up one set of human beings over against another that the church was pointing to. Now, somewhere in the process, it managed to speak in a way that is very close to some of those other institutions that you were talking about, leading, for example, to the, in a sense, criminalization of investment in such an evil system. At another point in history, when those institutions were speaking a different language, it was the church, now talking about after apartheid officially broke down, it was the church that led the way in the truth and reconciliation exercise, which is different. And the states recognize that, that if this can be done authentically, it has to be led from a faith perspective. And it was, and the truth and reconciliation played that role. It's a different model than, let's say, the Nuremberg trials, or what any other institution would have done. And I think that these are some of the distinctions that we could point to.
Excellent. Did you want to follow up on that, Henriette?
Well, one, you know, again, under the Nazi time, Bonhoeffer's discovery was that anybody who was committed to truth found each other. And so that the church gets very close, like, I mean, his brother was an atheist, right? And they worked, and his brother-in-law, you know, was probably a believer, but they all worked together on the same issues, and one with a legal expertise and the other was a scientist, etc. So you use your expertise, but you find ultimately, if God is the source of truth, that wherever, you know, if Pembina does a good analysis or Parkland does a good analysis, yeah, that's way better. The church doesn't even have the money or the time to commission that kind of a study. You know, that's excellent, but part of our job is to mobilize civil society, the church as part of civil society, to actually then take some of these studies, or the recent one on healthcare, and then look at, okay, what is that saying, you know, about, let's say, the desire of privatizing healthcare, what is our moral mandate within that? So we can give a theological frame for people then to appreciate what the work is, you know. But we shouldn't have to duplicate, you know, some of those studies. But there are issues like creating a moral framework. If it's already shared by the community, that would be easy, but a lot of it is not broadly enough shared that people want alternative progress indicators as Pembina Institute does, for example. Right? So, okay, yeah, our faith tradition says, yes, there are alternative ways of measuring, you know, progress than only economic indicators.
Right? Good. One last. Walter?
The voice of the church has fallen silent, Lutheran and my own Presbyterian. We are debate in our own councils who speaks for the church. We muzzle our moderators. We have no, we don't allow anyone to speak for us. Now, if the word has power, and if power is to be reinterpreted, then the question of together recognizing all that we've been saying tonight and finding a way in which together recognizing what we're looking at, we begin to be heard. Because at the moment, the only voice that is heard, earlier in the day, Setri was commenting that the so-called evangelical voice of the biblical literalist represents only a small minority. But that minority view, which is over against what we've been sharing together out of Reform and Lutheran background, is spoken with confidence, with boldness, with power, and increasingly, though, is being dismissed as another interest group and being managed, whether it is the public issues that today divide the major parties or others. And the question of the larger issues, I sense some agreement, we could talk about as the sin of poverty, the sin of hunger, the sin where the creational goodness can be shared. That voice, which has a voice of power because of its compassion or love, is not heard. And to me, I find, having chaired the Commission on World Concerns of the Canadian Council of Churches, having never now a voice of the Council of Churches in Canada, we have become a forum so that we can hear each other, but nothing is heard outside. So in our discussions, if Lutherans and Presbyterians, we could begin to even think, who speaks for us now? And will we even allow one of our bishops or moderators or somebody to begin again to express our own weakness, but at the same time, the sense of dependence on the power of God? Well, I just find that that while we recognize that we're no longer the dominant role,